Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's a podcast hosted by me, Kyle Schoenewill, and my longtime friend from work, Robbie Earle. Now, we say all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe all the time, but I'm not sure we've ever meant it quite as literally as today, because it's not every day, if you can see this, that you are joined by the writers of the new book, The Reign of Marvel Studios. Joanna Robinson.
The profile view also, just to show
how
much we're talking all things in the MCU.
All things. Joanna, Dave, and Gavin, welcome to Friends from Work. Let's go.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. Hello.
I'm so glad you guys have the finished copies that are so shiny and like got the beautiful end papers, the whole package.
They are shiny. I should say also, my wife, who's a graphic designer, is not often complimentary of the Marvel-related things that I bring into our household, but this one was the exception. She made a point to talk about how nice the cover is, so
congrats
on passing that particular test.
I'm just now noticing the Iron Man.
I consider it a little Easter egg. Here's my favorite fact about the cover. I mean, we had a really, really talented designer work on the cover. Incredible stuff. But the core conceptual design for the cover came from Mr. Dave Gonzalez, here on the call with you, who is also a graphic designer in his other life. So, yeah, that was his whole idea. And the publisher had pitched us a bunch of different ideas, and Dave was like, what about this, though? And then we all picked our jaws up off the floor and said, yes, that's the one. So
I was looking at the janky Photoshop of it the other day, and I was just like, you became so much more than this janky Photoshop little image.
that I think is maybe representative of the Marvel Studios story as well. So that seems fitting.
Yeah, best idea wins.
So I just got this book overnighted to me yesterday. So I'm not finished. Obviously, it's comprehensive. I'm a little ways through it, but
everything goes great with the MCU until the end, and nobody is ever unhappy.
Yeah,
there you go. Well, I'm loving what I'm reading so far. I guess my first question to you all is why? What drove you to write this comprehensive of a story?
Well, I think above all else, there's a number of different factors, but I think above all else, as fans of the MCU, as longtime journalists, as curious people, we just wanted this book to exist, like for ourselves, essentially. Dave and I have been talking back and forth about worked together for, I think, over a decade now, Dave. Oh my gosh. Have been talking back and forth about some of these stories for years and years and years. And so, our publisher, Norton, approached us in 2019 when Endgame came out, when it felt like sort of the capper of a certain era of Marvel, and said, hey, what about the Marvel story? What do you think about that? And Dave and I got really excited to do that. We worked on that for a while, and then we were so lucky to find Gavin to come in and help us pull it all together. And Gavin comes with this wealth of knowledge of the comics, journalistic experience, that like really fun zippy tone makes the pages turn themselves, I think is a phrase Gavin used the other day.
I don't know where you came from. I was just like,
it's great.
Does it make sense?
That's it. That's the magic. That's the magic that Gavin
brings.
That's
Gavin. So yeah, then it all comes together. But like at the bottom of it, even though Gavin is sort of like new to our fellowship, new-ish, it's been a few years, but like new-ish to our fellowship, we all share that love of the MCU, but sort of healthy skepticism and curiosity about who is feeding us these stories. What is the story, the superheroic struggle battle story behind the story? All of that is really interesting to us.
Somebody asked me this morning, like, you know, is the MCU like good or bad or neither? I'm like, it's both.
Both and.
You can both like love what it is and say, you know, like recognize that there's flaws in the edifice.
Feels like something you could say about Marvel Comics as a whole. Like if you're trying to look at, to the extent that the MCU is a microcosm for the Marvel story that we've been getting since 61 or before, however you want to look at that. I think that it's, if you're a comics fan or a critic or someone that's interested in that, I think you have to learn to kind of hold both of those things. Like I remember when we had Douglas Wolk on the show and we were talking about the old Shang-Chi comics. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how that was, on the one hand, one of his favorite series to go back and read, and how great and gripping it was, and also how clearly problematic a lot of it is. And it feels like that's a really extreme example. But I think that there are elements of that anytime you're looking at something that's this sprawling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, especially with, you know, sort of the struggle for control between the Marvel Comics entity and the early Marvel Studios entity, where they're like, maybe these are both, but, you know, Ike Perlmutter and his various comic book people are like, well, actually, these are all things, ways to make money. Like, don't stop thinking of them about revenue streams first, and sort of trying to wrestle that away and starting to think about the audience like a little bit of, you know, EICs for the comics have been doing a lot, but also for the movies, instead of being like, just let Bryan Singer disrespect the property. It had to become like, no, let's take the good things from the comic books and bring it to the movies. We could talk about Bryan Singer. There's that much of him in the book.
But that's because
Dave kept getting angry. Yeah.
So you guys are all already, or were, experts on the MCU before you wrote this book, but in all of your research, because I mean, this is, you went through and interviewed a ton of actors and writers, directors, all this stuff. Like, in your research, was there one thing or a couple things that particularly stand out to you? Something you didn't know, or something that really blew your mind, a storyline or a project or something like that?
I think there's two that strike me sort of right away as if this had gone any differently, or we wouldn't have gotten any of these films in the first place. So there's the business story, obviously, that you know, first couple chapters are interested in, and just the, what still seems to me, the people who made the deal don't think this, but still seems to me to be one of the wildest gambles of all time, to sort of leverage several of their, what would become their all-star characters off to get the financing in the first place to launch Marvel Studios. That seems to me highly improbable that ever would have worked in the first place, and yet it did. Then there's Iron Man itself, and Iron Man, we interviewed so many people who worked on the set of Iron Man, and that is just a chaotic set, and the fact that they got what they got out of that without a clear script hammered out in advance, with things constantly changing on the fly, with this sort of like independent cinema approach to Iron Man. It's astonishing to me that it exists. And then you get to the Hulk chapter, and there's the problems with Edward Norton, their leading man. So just like it just all seems so rickety at the start, and you look at where they landed and how impenetrable they came for a while, but like how shaky the start. I think that's something I didn't fully have a sense of until we dug into it.
Yeah, I think for me, as somebody who was covering it more as a fan online when the MCU started, I was always really interested in, like, you know, what's behind the scenes, and, you know, like, what are all the Easter eggs in the movie? I was surprised with stuff like with Wakanda showing up on a map in, like, Iron Man 2.
Yes.
That's not an Easter egg. That's them trying to get there. And there's somebody at that point in, you know, the Marvel Creative Committee that's like, you know, these guys aren't going to sell action figures, so, like, you can't do Black Panther, or you can't do Doctor Strange, even though he gets name dropped in another movie. And it's like, those aren't Easter eggs for the fans as much as they were, like, markers for the production being like, no, we are going to nail this into your head until you are begging for a Black Panther movie, and we're going to show our overlords that the audience is out there. And eventually they did. So I was often surprised, especially in an era where, like, I think Star Wars and Lucasfilm were maybe listening to fan reaction a little bit too much.
Yes.
When regard to their future projects, Marvel seemed to have, like, never really been listening to the fans. They're like, we're gonna go here, and we're gonna not offend anybody, but we're going to go directly towards these like absolutely weird things. We're going to bring you the Infinity Stones. We're going to, you know, bring you eventually like She-Hulk as a streaming show, like all these weird ideas that when at the turn of the century, superhero movies started coming out, seemed like completely out there. And then I think it was Guardians of the Galaxy hitting as big as it did that started getting people to realize that, like, we could take the weirdest stuff that we have, and as long as we have a good creative team behind it and, you know, can make it a James Gunn fun space romp, people are going to show up in droves as much as they would for Iron Man or Thor.
So I love that, though. Dave and Joanna, like, were working on this book for years before I joined the project. And so for me, it was just sort of like, you know, like opening the room and is just full of Easter eggs, like all the questions I ever had about Marvel MCU, they had found answers to, like, hey, are those like comics like are used in the logo when like they're flipping through the pages? Turns out that they're like originally commissioned for that. I didn't know, you know, sort of why they changed like Bruce Banner's name to David on the TV show. Turns out it was homophobia. So, and one of the big things I'll say, just because Joanna reminded me of it by saying rickety, is the extent to which the Marvel Studios offices were done, like held together by scotch tape, essentially. That there were literally chairs and conference rooms that you would sit down on and they would collapse. And so even after it became this, you know, like billion-dollar enterprise, you know, like seeing like the high contrast between like the money on the screen and the absolute, you know, sort of like Spartan, you know, sort of scuffling by studios and accommodations.
Right.
That was really fascinating to me.
By the way, speaking of Easter eggs, I love your Easter eggs in the book, not only at the beginning of each chapter, quoting something from the movie that sets up the chapter, but there's a chapter where you're like, we came to a screeching halt, like a helicarrier falling from the sky or whatever. So I love that kind of stuff. So that was fun. Good job on the writing there.
Classic Gavinism, first of all. Secondly, have you looked at the notes at the back of the book?
Nope.
I'm going to do it right now. I was looking at those this morning, actually.
If you flip through them, you might find a surprise waiting for you in the notes section.
Okay.
What's a Marvel anything without a post-credit scene, I guess.
Yeah, there you go.
Talking about the start of the MCU and kind of how uncertain things were, it strikes me that there is a bit of a parallel between the MCU in phase one and the MCU in phase four and five, or, you know, post-Endgame, however you want to look at it, even down to the fact that, as I think you all note in the book, you have something resembling a creative committee come back. With the, what is it, the Marvel Parliament. And obviously, you know, it's very different, and I think the way it's comprised and imposed. But I wonder, is there anything that, you know, as phase four and five were kind of happening in real time, I'm guessing you were, you know, digging back in time to the early mid-2000s. And was there anything that kind of struck you there about some parallels or maybe like lessons that you're seeing that Marvel learned or is having to relearn?
I think what you're identifying is basically it took them years and hard-won custody battles with Marvel East Coast, etc., for them to fully hammer out what we sometimes call the Marvel method, you know, to figure out who to bring in-house, who has final say on certain things, all of that took a really long time for them to figure out, though they figured out certainly faster than DC over at Warner Brothers, et cetera, right? And so they have this Marvel method that is putting out banger after banger, and then you get this, you know, note from their Disney overlords to amp up production. And the question then becomes, and this is something that, you know, within the last year, someone who was there at the very beginning of Marvel said to me on the phone is like, is this method something you can scale up? Is there scalability in the Marvel method in order to go from putting out a couple movies a year to putting out several TV shows and a couple movies a year on top of that? And can a Marvel method that includes a figure like Kevin Feige sort of somewhat shadow directing all of these films by saying, hey, bring me the pieces of the movie you're working on back here to California and I'll help you put this movie together. Well, he can't do that for every single project. And then, so then you get the Parliament, which is filled with incredibly, incredibly talented, long standing people at Marvel, but they're not Kevin Feige. And, you know, I don't want to say he's irreplaceable, but thus far it seems like he might be kind of irreplaceable. And so I don't see it so much as they're recreating the creative control inside their own halls as they found a method that worked for the output that they were doing. And then all of a sudden they tried to scale it up and then you dilute that power of Feige, that creative juice sure. from Feige across, again, a number of very talented people. And you're mm-hmm. back to that sort of, maybe to your point, too many cooks in the kitchen approach to storytelling where they had streamlined it down to something really slick before.
Well, and with the people you've talked with, they must be aware of that now, right? It seems like it's shifting back to a slowdown a little bit.
Dave, you want to talk about Bob Iger?
That was happening right at the end as we were finishing up the book because Bob Iger came back. And we had outlined when they entered the streaming era how the transition out of Bob Iger into Bob Chapek for a period of time really upped the production amount that was needed. And then, Kevin Feige is currently trying to save Marvel movies he didn't have any control over, Bob Iger had to come back and save Disney from stuff that he set in motion and then didn't really work out. So it's been interesting in terms of like the parallels between phase one and the new phases that we're in. I can sort of see where we're going, but I think they've also, after Endgame, they cashed their check for trust in the first couple of projects that came out. That was delayed by the pandemic, which also made it seem like higher stakes. But we spent a lot of time in phase four being introduced to wildly different corners of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and legacy characters that would eventually, or hopefully will eventually, become Avengers. It was a lot different from them setting out at the beginning, being like, okay, we're going to make Iron Man and Hulk. And then we're going to make Thor and Captain America. And if you know anything about the Avengers, you know what we're building towards. And each one of those was like each phase, you'd have a movie from each one of the main characters so that it eventually would make a trilogy and you would have a big crossover movie. And it was only things like Guardians of the Galaxy or like Doctor Strange or like Ant-Man where initially they kept them at a distance. And then once the movies were successful, they brought them into like the full world. So we're right now in the beginning of phase five, sort of wandering around, having been trained for over a decade to have like this cadence of what to expect and what characters to see. They're just like, no, we're going to throw Werewolf by Night at you. Blah. Here's some Moon Knight. Nah. And it's like, are you going to see these characters again? I don't know. You want to see these characters again? Meanwhile, Kevin Feige's cooking in his little kitchen being like, here's what I would have changed about the X-Men movies and the Spider-Man movies that I didn't have full control over. And like, here's No Way Home. Here's Deadpool 3. So I think it's been an excellent time where they're reclaiming. But again, the sort of wavering fan expectations or the decreasing box offices, I don't know how much that's concerning to them. Although I think something like Secret Wars, which is like 6 episodes, $200 million, that should be concerning. Hopefully they're paying attention to that.
Secret
Invasion, yes. Yeah. Secret Wars is going to cost so much more than $200 million.
I did. I made exactly that, the flip-flop of that on an interview earlier this week.
I was sitting here thinking, Secret Wars is 6 parts? Did I miss something?
You heard it here first from David Zawa, it's a scoop.
I saw in reading the book, you referenced that at the start you had a lot of cooperation from Disney and that kind of as you went, it seemed like there was a bit more pushback. And I was curious how you first started feeling that, if it was subtle or if it was not so subtle, and kind of why that happened when it did.
Yeah, I am... Disney has a long history, and we knew this going in, of not wanting people to know exactly how the sausage gets made. You know, they want their hand in the telling of their story at any given level. And they also, you know, they have publishing wings. They have this, that, and the other thing. They're like, well, if someone's going to write this book, we want to write this book. You know, so they did have their own version come out somewhere in the middle of our writing process. And that, I think that was part of it, is they were like, well, we're working on our own thing. Why would we help you with your thing? That book exists. That book is very interesting, and it tells a story, but it does not tell the full story, because it tells Disney's version of the story. And, you know, there's a lot of cool glossy photos in there and stuff like that. There's a lot to admire, but we were curious to tell something else, which was, you know, give us the whole story. We're not here to bash Marvel. We're not here to, this is not like muckraking journalism. We're not here to like get all, give you all the dirt that ever was. But we were like, well, you're not being fully transparent with all the things that happen. Understandably so. This is more, almost more PR than it is journalism, and that's fine. But so Disney, the way it, you know, I'm speaking to this because I was one doing all the interviews at the start. And so I was the one seeing the emails come back from publicists saying like, well, we heard from Disney that they, you know, Disney never said it to us directly, right? They never, with one exception that I can think of, never said anything to us really directly. It more came through third party channels, and we sort of said, okay, now we understand what's going on. And so then we needed to get creative. And we were talking about this the other day, just, you know, every journalist ever sort of trying to tell the story of a giant corporation has had to get creative with how they get access to the story that they need. This is just good old fashioned journalism. And so, you know, trying to work around, trying to cajole work sources, we still wound up with, you know, over 100 interviews, and plenty of those directly from, you know, spending a couple hours with Kevin Feige, talking to a lot of the actors. You know, we have all of that insight is in there. There's a lot of original interviews and reporting. There's also some people on background, some people who were talking to us because they were like, you won't tell Disney I talked to you, right? You know, and those stories are in there too. So, yeah, it became an interesting, and I actually, I know this is going to sound like our own PR and spin, but I actually think it made the book better, because first of all, that lit a fire under us to be like, oh, okay, you're going to close some doors? I don't think so. And secondly, I think then just sort of like digging for those stories. Okay, what is it Disney is afraid for us to know? And again, it's not, we're fans. We're not here to bash Marvel. That's not the point. But okay, so what, you know, what are some of the little like inner battles and conflicts and difficult personalities that Disney would rather smooth over and make everything seem like shiny, happy people holding hands? And, you know, like what, you know, what actually happened? So I'm, you know, I don't want to say I'm grateful to Disney for making our life much harder, but it did make the book better. So that makes, you know, that makes me happy at the end of the day.
My final question for you guys is a two-parter. We on our podcast have two kinds of listeners. You know, we're always going to get the diehards, and then we have some casual fans. And I'm guessing that this book is going to draw two crowds: the diehard MCU fan that just wants to know everything possible about the whole behind the scenes, and then the just general film fan that maybe isn't as into Marvel, but is intrigued at how this thing became what it became. What is one thing you hope each one of those parties takes away from this book? Like if a diehard MCU fan reads this book, what do you hope is their lasting takeaway? And same question for someone who's not as into the MCU.
My answer for someone who's not as into the MCU is one of my favorite chapters is write about Iron Man and MCU like in China. And, you know, it's this fascinating parallel that, you know, sort of like the rise of MCU happens at the exact same time that the Chinese film market opens up to outside movies, and just like getting into like, what are the finances of that and how does it work? And what are the, like, how does the co-production work? And then, you know, sort of like at a certain point when they shut down and they get sort of like, you know, very Disney-like non-answers to, you know, like, why are we doing this? And so for me, like the MCU ended up being one of the best ways possible to see what was going on with Chinese pop culture, which was not something that I expected, but I think is going to be interesting to anyone, whether they're a fan of Marvel superheroes or not.
That's a fascinating answer. Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's a great chapter. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say for non-Marvel fans, I think it's, or just casual film fans, this book is actually much more about that. When we were, I would try to, you know, pitch it to my casual in real life friends, and they're like, well, like, do I have to rewatch any like Marvel movies to do it? I'm like, no, I don't think you have to watch any of the Marvel movies, honestly. Like, you absorbed enough of it from the monoculture to know what we're talking about, because this is a book that is about the business of making blockbuster movies from an existing IP. This is a franchise. This is an examination of franchise, and the biggest one that we've seen to date. So that's what I think a non-Marvel fan could take away from this book. If you're a Marvel fan, Joanna and I dealt with this for a while we were putting together like early outlines, like, you know, who is this for? Like, there's going to be people that know a lot of this. Like, maybe we have like a couple of pop stories, but like, or big quotes, but like, if you've been following like we had through the actual production, you probably heard rumors of a lot of these stories before. Like, what are we doing here, and how do we make this, you know, something that like a Marvel fan that already knows it all gets something else out of? And the answer to that question was Gavin Edwards, because it's just fun to read. Like, the book is fun to read. If you know everything, you haven't seen it presented in this way, you haven't seen certain connections between stories you made sort of be connected across time the way that the book goes. And it's just a fun flow full of those, you know, Helicarrier like language Easter eggs that will really benefit you more if you, you know things about Marvel and MC Scat Cat.
I just want to say, like, right back at you, like, for like hardcore like Marvel fans, the deep, deep research that like Dave and Joanna did, like, off the top of my head, what happened to Karen Gillan's hair after she shaved it on to be in Guardians? And like,
oh gosh,
doing the like spade work and find it, like, you know, sort of it got made into a wig. Where is that wig? And, you know, sort of like think that like any like, you know, sort of like MCU fan who just wants to like really like find out all of the fascinating facts that they didn't even know they were craving, that, you know, like the fact that there's so much of it that spilling out of this book is like Joanna and Dave's like superhuman work. So
thanks, Gavin. I will say my favorite Gavinism. Did this make it? This made it into the final copy. The Psy blades in the parking lot line.
Yes.
That was like, that's one of my favorite Gavinisms that he put in there. To answer your question, and Dave is completely correct that I, in particular, I think, spent years saying, "Who is this book for, guys?" You know, and the answer that came down, and again, it's going to sound like spin and PR, but for everyone, that there's something for everyone. That was what we finally landed on, and that is the hope. And what I will say about those little nuggets of information is it was my greatest fear that people like you two, who host this podcast and know so much about Marvel already, will read this book and say, I already knew all of that, guys. Like, you're not telling me anything new. But what we have heard from those people who have had a chance to read the book already is there are things they didn't know. There are things that we dug up that they weren't aware of, and that thrilled me to my core, because like the my biggest fear is someone's going to throw the book down and be like, boring, knew it, TLDR or something like that, and that's not the response we've been getting. So that's one aspect of it. The other thing for the diehard Marvel fan is I hope it introduces sort of like a healthy curiosity about, okay, these are the stories you love. Who's telling you these stories? I think it's always interesting to ask, who is telling me these stories? Who is presenting me with these heroes? Why are these the heroes that I am following? You know, so when we think about, I was like ranting at a bookstore about this the other day. These stories are so important because, yes, they're for all ages, but they are, those of us who grew up with these, we know, particularly formative when you're young. These are stories aimed at young people. And so it is important to know what kind of heroic figure our young people are, you know, thinking about, looking at, and who decides who's a hero in the eyes of like the next generation coming up. And so when you move out of the era that stars white men named Chris, an era film that I love those Chris's, but then you move into the era where you get a Carol Danvers and you get a T'Challa and you get all these other figures, learning the story of who decides when that happens, I think, is a healthy thing for Marvel fans to know a little bit more about. And then for the non-Marvel fans, I will just say that, like, what I would like as a Marvel fan, as a longtime journalist, how about a little more respect for the MCU and what they created in Hollywood and their their stamp on a decade of filmmaking. Like, preach. I understand the critiques. You know, when Marty Scorsese gets one on about the MCU, sure. I'm like, I kind of get it, Marty. I get it. Mm-hmm. Like, I too miss, you know, the mid-level adult film, if you prefer. But, like, I think that what they've accomplished, the way in which Kevin Feige took lessons from old Hollywood studio systems in order to accomplish that, makes this a story about, you know, the history of cinema. We're in a different different golden age, a silver age, if you will, of cinema. And who are the players and what is the information? And years down the line, when they're teaching film history class in university, like, right. I'm not saying they're going to use our book, but like, there is going to have to be a section in the textbooks about the reign of Marvel Studios. It's a part of film history. And so, yeah, put a little respect on the MCU's name. It was a player for a very long time, and it may yet continue to be.
Well, I love it, because even if you aren't a fan of the MCU, you're right. Clearly something resonates with the overall culture, whether you like it or not. And so I'm excited to dive into this more, because there's something going on there that you want to know what's happening. Like, why does it resonate so deeply with everybody?
Well, and to that end, my final question, which is maybe a little kitschy, but it's something that we generally like to ask folks, and I am especially interested to ask y'all. If you had to pick one project that is not like what you think is objectively the best thing that Marvel Studios has put out, but one that you just hold very near and dear, like if it's a rainy day and you've got time to kill, you're going to throw this on and it's like a comfort watch for you. Which project, film, or series would that be for each of y'all?
I just did a full rewatch of like every Loki property, because Loki season 2 is upon us. And so I just watched all the Thor movies, the Avengers movies, and Loki season 1. Loki season 1 is just like a real delight. And so I think in terms of like a comfort watch, and watching sort of Tom Hiddleston do his thing and Owen Wilson enter the MCU and all of that, Loki season 1 is a real favorite. But the old school classic favorite for me is Captain America Winter Soldier. That is my pinnacle of MCU filmmaking. I love that film so much. So shout out to my favorite white guy named Chris Evans and Steve Rogers and Captain America Winter Soldier. It matters a lot to me.
I think we have the same favorite white guy, Chris. So I'm with you there.
So for me, my absolute favorite transition from scene to scene in any Marvel movie is when you hear the Spinner's Rubber Band Man come on in Avengers
Infinity War.
And just like, and you go, here come the Guardians. Like, you know, like even before you cut to outer space, like, you know what's coming. And so there's so much in that movie that, like, you know, like, you know, don't make me, you're embarrassing me in front of the wizards.
right.
For me, like, it is like ridiculous that as long as it is and that there's so much going on in it. But if I just want to like take a long warm bath in like all things that are great about the MCU, I think that's the place to go.
Gavin's my guy.
I knew you were going to get Kyle with that one.
Yeah.
So my answer has recently been updated, because I was like, what do I actually rewatch the most out of the MCU? Because I've been collecting all the discs when they release things on discs. Thanks God we finally got Loki, and we're going to get WandaVision next month.
Yes.
But I would like all of them on disc, because I don't trust digital media to always be there for me. And I'd like to be back for it. So while I still have access to it, I think I watch She-Hulk twerk with Megan Thee Stallion the most of the entire MCU. It's just like, it's exactly what that character needed at that point in her series. And people hated on it so much. And just the second I saw it, I'm like, that is what Marvel can be now post-Endgame. Just like, not only is it a great visual effect, but it's not taking itself too seriously, but it's also meeting a very specific audience with something they'd never seen before. So it's very brief. It's a post-credit scene, but I rewatch it all the time, just like when I have an extra second to remind myself what I'm doing, talking about Marvel all the time.
You all are talking to the right guys.
Marvel, I quote the most, is it's got a why, but not where you think.
It's got a, yeah.
Yeah. It's not where you think. One of my favorite characters. Robbie knows.
Absolutely.
Yes.
An icon.
Well, the book comes out October 10. Is that correct? October 10 for the public?
Yep.
So, guys, if you're listening, go get this. The Reign of Marvel Studios. Look how good that looks.
Yeah. We can do some cross PR. That's also when tickets for the Marvels go on sale.
Oh, hey.
Buy the book, buy the tickets for some Marvels. You got a month to read and then go watch the Marvels. I think that's a great way to spend your October.
Perfect. Gavin, Joanna, Dave, you guys are absolute legends. Thank you for writing this book, and thank you for jumping on this podcast for a little bit. I'm excited to finish it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Such a good time.
Great question.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.